The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Yeah, yeah. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Ladies and gents, welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is Kyle Quincy Parker. I am the, the ebony of this particular keyboard. And I wish to present to you for your viewing and listening pleasure, the ivory of this particular keyboard.
Well, perhaps the strawberry ice cream. I've been in the sun.
Ah, fair enough. Okay. Well, I guess that makes me the chocolate ice cream.
Fair enough.
Okay, good. So now that we've made Davinia uncomfortable, I have introduced myself appropriately. I beg you to do the same.
I am your humble co-host, ready to run the checklist, get this plane off the ground.
Indeed, indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for flying with Sunday Scotch Society Air today. Our destination is a secret. You'll just have to stick around to find out. Matthew, how you doing, man?
Life is life, and also it's hot, babe.
It is hot.
Have you been outside in the last month?
Oddly enough, I have, and
dear God,
I have paid the price for it. Thank goodness for the rain, which has allowed us to, at the very least, pretend to experience some cooling down of the virulent heat that is assaulting us from this sun that is clearly on a mission. Every once in a while, I wonder. We talk about how we are a Christian nation, and most Bahamians, at least culturally, go to church with some regularity. So when this kind of heat is upon us, is it that we are suffering under the gaze of an angry God? Is this the start of a plague? Are we being punished for national sin? What is happening?
All of the above.
But as an avowed and acknowledged agnostic, how can you know?
I can't. But I get to play in this space of... Sure. That's what it is.
Okay, fine. No worries. So how's things been going? What's new? What's exciting? What's happening?
Man, listen. It always with the hard questions.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's just it's very hectic time. I cannot wait for October. I think it will be busy, but in another way. But I am happy to be looking forward to exercising at least some creativity in my activities then. This has just been a slog, I would say, since July. However, I am happy to report that I have not gained the weight that I thought I did. So I'm still on a downward trend. I got 20 more to go, but I am down 15 to 20 at this point.
Congratulations.
From my high. So
I wondered if you were on drugs. You do seem to be. Yeah, you know, your neck, and that's the thing. We always know from the neck, right? When the neck starts to get skinny, and then you start to see that jawline show up. It's usually somebody either seriously losing weight because of like diet changes. Or they hitting the drugs pretty hard. And, you know, I mean, I was just curious. No judgment either way. You know what I'm saying?
What happened to Vivian?
Yeah, no, this one's just ketones.
Well, I congratulate you. As a person who had made a public commitment to getting back into Speedo body shape by the end of the summer of 2024 and who failed miserably, I too am on a journey. I am down. The last time I stepped on the scale, I was down 20 pounds from the beginning of the year.
Okay.
But I have 100 to go. So you and I are, we are on similar journeys with some slight differences.
Yeah, and when I committed with you to the Beachbody, I committed to next year.
Yeah, that was you.
Yeah.
Because
I didn't realize that you were committing to this year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I was committing to the end of summer 2024. Because, of course...
This matches your personality of going hard.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And paying the price for it. Especially when you fail. If you take a spectacular swing, you fail spectacularly. And that's okay. Hey, but when you succeed...
This is actually a very important evolutionary strategy. Mm-hmm. Is to have most of the hive, most of the colony group, mm-hmm. you know, from insects to mammals, follow a particular program, but then 10 to 20% of them swing hard. Sometimes spectacular payoff. Most of the time, you don't hear from them genetically anymore.
But the spectacular payoff.
Oh, yeah.
It is a paradigm change for the better, usually, and not just for the individual, but for the whole colony.
Oh, yes.
So one could say that by swinging spectacularly, I am actually doing national service.
Whatever makes you sleep at night.
Melatonin. So today's tipple, Matthew, is the most popular, well, the best-selling scotch in Scotland.
Oh, it sounds rather famous.
And it is a blended scotch, and it is my favorite of the blended scotches. Blended, we had a whole, I don't think you were there for this, but I did a whole tutorial on the show about the difference between single malt, single grain, blended, mm-hmm. and the different kinds of scotch whiskey there are. And what a blended scotch is you take the scotches from different producers, from different distilleries, mm-hmm. and a blender, a master blender, blends scotches from different distilleries to create a product with a couple of different, you know, blends in it. Kaolila is a popular one. There some of the ones that have become sort of niche market single malt scotches recently, like by recently in the Scotch world, that's like the last 20 years, have traditionally been just used in blends. And because Scotch has become so popular, and especially single malt, some of these blend components have kind of tried to make their way into the single malt space.
Interesting.
Yeah. But that's what a blended Scotch is. And mm-hmm. You know, your typical examples in the Bahamas, you got your Dewars, you got your Johnny Walker, and those are the two sort of market leaders here. But the best blended Scotch I have ever tasted is the famous Grouse, which is the scotch that we're going to try today. My favorite famous Grouse is the famous Grouse Smoky Black, which we tried before. I think the Smoky Black was the show right before we invented the list.
Yeah, your memory on these things are much better than mine.
Yeah, well, today we're trying the regular standard flagship, the famous Grouse, the flagship bottle. And it is time for us to do what we do, but because it's a screw top bottle, I'm going to refer to the thing as the pour, which is sort of usually step two.
Do the thing.
And for me, I can already get the nose accents just from opening the bottle. It's because it's a blend. It has a traditionally blends are a little sweeter than the single malt. Because you know they have the ability of the master blender to bring out certain characteristics.
That is coming the aroma from 2 feet away. You get some sweet notes on the nose there.
And then when I pull it in a little, not too close, but it is a little smoky.
Oh yeah, that gets smoky fast.
And there's a maybe a little tang on the edges as well. I traditionally associate that tang with citrus, but I wouldn't say that I get a citrusy aroma.
No, I'm not even picking that up. The tang. Well, it's more towards a tartness.
Okay.
I'm going to let my nose rest for a bit and come right back to that. So far, I am looking forward to this.
Well, good. Good. You should be. I will confess, this is not my first time with a bottle of the famous Grouse. I traditionally...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Is it true?
It is true. It is true. I confess that I've had... I will not say the number of bottles of this particular product in my possession across the years, but I am excited to share it with you, and I hope that it brings you as much joy as it has traditionally brought me. You know the next step.
Indeed.
We are now, ladies and gentlemen, about to taste. So Matthew is lost in contemplation. I will now taste my beautiful tulip glass of the famous Grouse. Yeah. So, as we traditionally do on the show, we talk a little bit about sort of the history of the tipple, and this dram is produced by the Edrington Group, which the name will be familiar if you've been paying attention to our sort of producers and distillers. The Edrington Group produces the Macallan, they produce the Glenfiddich, they produce the Highland Park, and they produce, which we haven't tried on the show yet, but we're going to, they also are responsible for the Brugal rums out of the DR, and this is their blended scotch. They used to also, the Edrington Group used to also own the Glenturret, which we tried on the show recently. But this is, so the famous grouse comes from an incredibly accomplished and I guess experienced is the word I'm looking for. Accomplished and experienced producer of whiskeys. So the tasting notes for the famous grouse are sort of soft, warm depth, quote unquote, with bright, fruity notes and a smooth, balanced finish. I'm not sure if you would agree.
I am not getting much of a fruity note.
Mm-hmm.
It is subtly sweet to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree with the warmth. They took that out of my mouth, so to speak. I have to say, I don't think this is very complex, mm-hmm. which is interesting because of the
process,
blended nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it is warm. It is you know, we lean so much on the word caramel here, but it has the feeling that you would get from a warm sweet, like warm brownies, mm-hmm. or fudge,
mm-hmm.
but not, yeah. not the tasting notes, but yeah. like the feeling that engenders.
Yeah.
I just feel like, oh, this is, I'm just going to sip this and enjoy the moment for a while. It's very interesting because, yeah, I don't feel like I need to search for the notes as I would in something that feels more complex to me in the mouth. But it's just downright enjoyable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So on the issue of complexity, what their process is they bring fine grain whiskies and quality single malts from some of Scotland's other distilleries together to create a fusion,
mm-hmm.
Which they say that it is the smoothness that we're experiencing is because of the absence of filtration, a harsh filtration. So when after the malt is distilled,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's filtered through the peat thing to give it that peaty smokiness, right? And what they're saying is that they don't have to filter it that way because of the choices that they've made in selecting the whiskies that go into the blend. And I think personally that that is why you would sense a almost a simplicity from this whiskey. It's not, it doesn't have spiky, obvious.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's it's just round, it's smooth, it has a hint of this and a hint of that. And overall the impression is I want another sip. And that I think is a testament to their craft. And of course, as a blended scotch, I am not averse to mixing this in like a nice whiskey sour or any of the, like a sidecar or any of the popular whiskey drinks.
Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't want to try to pay, for instance, for a Macallan whiskey sour. But a whiskey sour made with the famous grouse would be almost, I think, just as tasty and a tenth of the price, maybe. You know, so not a tenth of the price, but significantly cheaper. So yeah, I'm excited about the famous grouse, and I'm glad to have been able to introduce you to it in this context.
And what's the price range on a bottle for that?
$30 thereabouts.
Okay, yeah. So this should be on your shelf at home.
Definitely. What I would encourage our listeners to do is buy a bottle of the famous Grouse Smoky Black, buy a bottle of the Dewar's 12, or even the Dewar's 18, buy a bottle of the Johnny Walker Black or the Johnny Walker Double Black, and do your own little taste test. If you want to try like Scotch for Scotch, I put this up against the Johnny Red and the Dewar's 12.
You know, I've seen some stuff about the Johnny line, and I'm interested in eventually putting those back to back, because I think in a few tests that I saw, the green actually came out on top. So
yeah, but that is Johnny has, as does Dewar's, as does the famous Grouse, they have a range of products.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny's range of products is a little more extensive because they are marketing to a far more segmented audience than either Dewar's or the famous Grouse. I personally prefer the gold over the green, but the green is acknowledged by many people to be the pinnacle of the Johnny Walker line as far as taste.
Oh, okay.
So
this was presented in my poor memory. I remember this being a bit of a surprise. But
it would be a surprise to people who don't like Johnny Walker.
Okay.
And that is a great many people of what I would have to say is incredibly good taste. But, you know, here it is. Here we are. So, ultimately, I guess we're going to say that the Johnny Walker Dewar's blended Scotch market is competitive, but in my view, and I acknowledge that this is a personal Quincy Parker view, not a Sunday Scotch Society view, that in my view, the famous Grouse is the best blended the best blended whiskey on the market. Especially the famous Grouse Smoky Black, but the flagship bottle is also quite tasty. And I think you should go out and make sure you have a bottle of this on your shelf. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's for the shelf, not the list.
I agree with that. Although... No, you're right. There's no avo. So where are we? We have a country to save, and I feel very strongly about that.
We have a country that needs saving.
Right.
Not sure that particular grammatical construction is accurate, and as in.
You don't think we're the ones to save it? Or you don't think it's our responsibility to do so?
I have zero problem contributing. I am not taking the mountain on my back.
Matthew, what in your 40 years of experience on this life, in this country, tells you that there is anyone else seeking to save this country?
Oh, they're there.
I didn't ask you if they were there. I asked you what you have experienced or what evidence you can put into the common market.
I've met individuals.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So direct experience.
Uh-huh. And all of these individuals that you have met, mm-hmm. No doubt also said, I'm not taking the mountain on my back.
Oh, no. Some of them have. I mean, they mm-hmm. they tend not to be the ones who would it's highly unlikely in an objective assessment that they would be the more effective ones. But such people exist where right. they're going to take the mountain on completely. But I get your point. I just want to make it clear. I am not your savior. I don't want to be your savior. I'm not intending to be your savior, Bahamaland. I'm going to do what I think is helpful and right, and also not kill myself. So just to give you some context, listener.
I wonder whether or not we are... Okay. So the reason that I started this part of the conversation that way is because we have a platform.
We do.
Our platform is quite popular. Whether we're talking about the pod itself or the way the pod is distributed, mm-hmm. people love to listen to other people talk. In the Bahamas, anyone with a platform is almost automatically gifted with a level of benefit of the doubt that is unreasonable.
Agreed.
Right? The number of people who think that people with a platform must have solutions, must have good ideas even. The percentage is of the listening community that feels that way is very high. I don't know that I feel like that is earned. I don't know that I feel that it's warranted, but it's reality. It is how our community goes. They look to the people with the voice to be the ones to provide solutions. Even the people who have solutions to aspects of the problems facing the country, they will bring their solution to someone with a voice and say, tell people about this. Because they know that to just stand in the market and proclaim their solution, they won't get any traction. Nobody will listen to them, because who are they? Even though they're the one with the solution. So when I say we have a country to save, it is not that I think that you and I can save the country. Although, I do think that you and I could save the country. but what I'm saying is, I begin to accept some level of responsibility to nudge the needle in so far as we are able in what we think is useful direction.
I'm here for it.
Okay. Well, with that being said, what are we talking about today?
So, speaking of nudging, right, I happen to know a fair number of educators whom I have great respect for.
And you know a fair number that you don't.
You know, it's oddly way in favor of those that I do respect. And that may just be because I met the ones that I do respect first. Mm-hmm. And so there's a selection bias that happens down the road from that. But I did go through school, public system and private system. And I'm not... Listen, we don't have the worst system in the world.
No.
But there are issues. And speaking of earlier, the exploration, having a certain amount of people who go out there and take big swings, strategy in evolution. There's a particular deficit, I think, in the education system around conformity. And in the past, it may have been necessitated by the needs of like why this thing is designed the way it is designed to produce at first clerks and then, you know, people for the Industrial Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. But that need for conformity means that there are people on the edges who will have an outside impact in certain sectors who are really being underserved or just straight up abused. Not necessarily in a we hate you active, take the cane out and give them some whaps kind of way, although it does happen. But more in when you get into the neurodivergent people who may be able to give you a lot of creative solutions, and you have a system that essentially grinds them down day to day, you're taking out some talent that the country needs. So that has been a concern that's just been needling my mind since this is the back to school season.
It is back to school. And I saw the director of education talking about promotions and regularizing promotions and so on and so forth. And one of the things that comes to mind when you raise this subject is the level of autonomy that the teacher has in the classroom. Most people who are teachers, in my view, are fairly altruistic. They choose teaching as a career out of an altruistic motivation, out of some kind of sense that they want to help people. Mm-hmm. They want to, especially children, they want to guide, shape, mold, help, protect, whatever the case may be. That is often challenged by bureaucracy. It is challenged by debt and the struggle of actually getting qualifications. It is challenged by working conditions. It is challenged by the ceiling, the financial ceiling that is placed on the profession. And often when you hear a group of teachers get together and talk, the conversation between them is working conditions. It is very rare when you hear teachers get together and talk spontaneously that they're talking about their students. Now, when you talk to teachers individually, that's all they talk about is, I have this one student who, well, boy, let me tell you about this student. Let me tell you about this child. But their group experience, it almost feels like they see themselves as prisoners of war, and they huddle for protection, and they are immediately hostile towards anyone who is trying to break that huddle. And I think that plays out to an extent in the classroom, because you cannot, I'm going to name the child Tommy, right? Tommy is a nice unisex name, so Tommy could be a boy or Tommy could be a girl. So you can't help Tommy, who is neurodivergent and needs particular attention and maybe an maybe a disproportionate amount of time. You can't help Tommy and also get the rest of these students to pass the BJC and also make sure their parents sign and return all of these permission slips and also make sure you pay your union dues and attend your professional development requirements and also look after your own children and also make sure your wife or your husband is satisfied with your contribution to the home and to the marriage and also pay your tithes in church and make sure that the deacon board realized that you still saved and sanctified and filled with the Holy Ghost. And also, and also be on your softball team and be there to rehearsal every Saturday and make sure that, well, not rehearsal, but practice every Saturday and make sure when game day come, you could hit at least one base hit or at least pitch somebody out. And then when your child come to you and say, Mommy, I won't go to boarding school, try not to knock the block off. Right? The reality that I think is confronting so many of our teachers is that teaching is not done in a vacuum. And every bit of life experience that you have intrudes into the classroom. And it is up to the teacher generally to make that intrusion either a positive, well, make it a positive, right? And I wonder sometimes whether or not neurodivergent children or even children with behavioral idiosyncrasies, let's not call them problems, right? I'm not talking about problem kids. Problem kids need to be treated like problem kids. I don't know what that means, but that's what I mean. But kids who talk because they're excited, not because they're being rude, not because they're gossiping, but because they're excited by the subject matter that the teacher is presenting them, shouldn't be punished for talking because they're excited about what they're learning. But how does a teacher make that distinction when there are 30 children and they are attempting to make sure that each of those 30 children receives the same amount of teaching during this period of time? You've presented a very interesting challenge. I wonder what you think the solution is to the problem that you present.
Well, first of all, I don't want to make this about teachers. I think in that light, it's probably a mistake for me to open distinguishing that, you know, I know a lot of good teachers. And let's be real, there are some problem teachers in the system. I just wanted to make it clear that I am not attacking them. Especially knowing that they're doing such a good, the ones that I know in general are doing such a good job. This systemic problem, well, let's just start with 30 kids to a classroom, right? Mm-hmm. And then the overall conformity needs, like we got to get these to pass BJC or BGCSE or whatever is coming up. I think when you want to do something different in an established system, right, you have to look at it as it is. And the principle of hacking is not how do I break something. It's okay, the system acts this way. How do I use the way it's acting to get a result that is not expected in the system?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't come in and try to brute force things in all cases. You come in and you're like, oh, okay, you are doing all these things. They're having these outcomes. But if I tweak something here in the chain, I actually get a different outcome. So just having space in the classroom for, let's go back to the talker, because they're excited, right? The positioning in that classroom would be, and then how you seat children would be very important, right? And then having an expectation around what speech means in a classroom. But instead of trying to tamp it down, like they all want to talk. They want to talk for different reasons, right? But I'm sorry I can't cite the studies right now, but there are studies looking at play in children in schools, right? And if you just let the smaller ones out there with no guidance, it's chaos. That's to be expected, right? But if you are in a playground where there are older children with an established culture, this is what you do, this is how you play games, etc. That's just automatically, because we're humans, transmitted down. So if there's a culture inside the classroom where there are leaders, just because of their experience or their nature, and I don't mean we're going to lead you, the tribe, I mean leading particular activities, right? So if this person, you know this person is excited about bio, and they're just going to be the center of that little cluster of kids over on that side. And then who's the other person who could kind of quote-unquote lead a conversation over here in this cluster, right? That's one potential solution that could be explored within the system. There's also, how difficult is it to have these kids, like, not necessarily have to conform and be in that system every day, etc. There are simple things that could be done. They're simple. They're not easy because bureaucracy is BS, right?
To get bureaucracy might be BS, Matthew, but bureaucracy is also entrenched.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So there are simple solutions. If you get the right people at the right time to change things in the bureaucracy, then I think a lot of this could be alleviated.
The changes that you have identified, I think both of those changes are reflected in the education plan. I think Education 2020 is what the document was called. The first iteration was started under Carl Bethel, and when Jeff Lloyd was a minister, he updated it, and when Jerome Fitzgerald was a minister, he finished it, and he and Jeff Lloyd made a big deal about a bipartisan education plan that had been drafted completed after a couple of iterations, and they presented the plan in the House of Assembly. They laid it on the table, which means that it's now a public document, and anyone who wants it can go to the House of Assembly and ask the clerk for a copy of the Education 2020 or whatever the education plan's name is. I think it's Education 2020. I'll certify it in a second. But that plan was supposed to be the groundwork and the foundation for not just curriculum change, not just updates to the curriculum and to the teaching path and to the structure for how teachers progress, but also classroom management styles, also teaching methodologies like giving children who have particular psychological needs the atmosphere, the environment, in which to thrive, while also servicing the majority of the children in the way that they might learn best, right? That it's all there, and the the failing of our particular society. I won't say every society, because I've only lived in this one for the majority of my life. I've lived in the U.S. for a while, but we see their issues fairly regularly. But our issue is, one of our issues is that we will study a thing, we will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in resources on that study, and we will engage experts and create a plan. We will submit this plan to the executing authority, and we will then announce the creation of a plan and the submission of said plan to the executing authority. And the executing authority, if it is politically viable, will come to the public square and preach an entire sermon about how, at their instance, whether it was at their instance or not, they caused the creation of this plan, and they now have this plan in hand, and this plan will be the groundwork for the revolution that they will introduce in whatever aspect of Bahamian society. And then people in the communities that are to be affected might begin to get a little excited. 6 months pass, the excitement starts to teeter off. A year passes, no more excitement from the community that was to be affected, because they haven't seen hide nor hair of even a shred of an iota of a concept of a plan, to quote Donald Trump, to 2 years passes, nothing. 10 years passes. The plan, along with a fully executable action plan, with steps to be taken, sitting on a shelf in some ministry, gathering dust. 20 years passes, and somebody says, you know what we need? We need a plan. And so hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent. Experts are engaged. Work is done. Genuinely and with absolute commitment. Genuine work is done. These people are not spinning their tires. They really believe they are doing this work for the first time. And they're going to change their country. Except for one or two experts who've been around for 50 years who happened to get engaged, and they're the bitter ones saying, we did all this before. And so they get let go from the contract because they ain't on their run. And now you have another plan with another fully executable action plan that is presented to the public again. And in 2 years, it's sitting on a shelf next to the first one, gathering dust. That is a failing of Bahamian society that is, in my view, responsible for the fact that what you are talking about, which in my view is simple but not easy, changes that could be made that would revolutionize our educational input and output. But those changes, I was about to say will never be made, but I don't want to be pessimistic. Those changes have not yet been made because the system is invested in inertia. These people who are sitting in the halls of power are invested in the status quo in a way that disincentivizes them to actually implement these plans. Yes, I said it. I mean it. As the song say, let the chips fall where they may.
Well, I'll drink to that sobering thought and take the irony as you may.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, it's been good to see you again. And dear listener, we hope to talk with you soon.
Matthew, this was an interesting conversation. I want you to find those studies and remind me so I could dig up the name of the report so we can continue this conversation. Maybe we can get a teacher or a couple of people from education in to have this conversation with someone who's an actual stakeholder outside of our particular stake in this party. It's always good to be with you, my friend. Blessings. And what is it that coffee was in? Blessings are all upon the right hand. Gratitude is a must. Yes. And so on and so forth. Yeah. Enjoy your day, my friend. And to you, ladies and gentlemen, das vidanya.
Ciao.
Check it out.